years. You guys know the deal. This is not news to anybody, but yeah, every now and then I like to put on a jacket. It's just, I don't know, something different. But we are, we're beginning a new journey today, a new series. And there's something captivating about war. There's something about the stories of war that captivate our attention, that enthrall us. The idea of brave men and women rushing into glorious battle for the sake of God and country, it captivates our imagination. And when we think about the history of even just America, many of the portraits that are elevated to historic, heroic status are people who played pivotal roles in the war. Change, though settings and causes and personnel are ever shifting, the narrative of most of humanity is found in the story of its wars. And it's been that way since the very beginning. From day one, there's been a war going on. It began with a war of the wills between God's heart and our own. It began with a loss for us that we may have defined as a win at the time, but it escalated through our rebellion to a war of brother versus brother, and it morphed from there as a war of clan versus clan, family versus family, until it finally became kingdom versus kingdom, empire versus empire. And though we live in a time of unparalleled peace in the world right now that we live, at least compared with humanity's history, we find ourselves amid another epic struggle for something more valuable than territory or land, far more than power or influence, and far more than prestige or glory. It's a war for your soul. And it's a war that cannot be ignored. Paul reminds us in the book of Ephesians chapter 6 that though other matters appear to be pressing and cannot be ignored, it is the unseen battle that rages on that we must be keenly aware of, because everything hinges on the outcome of this war for your heart. Ephesians 6:12 says, "For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms." And this battlefield hidden just below the surface, it is this battle that we cannot afford to lose ground. It is this war that is so easy to miss, but is so critical to win. It is this war that we are more than often completely unaware, but we cannot, we must not lose. This series that we're in is called Game of Thrones, and I can't even call it a reference to the award-winning blockbuster television and book series, because it's not really a reference, it's literally stealing a name, I suppose. But for the uninitiated, Game of Thrones, in its basic form, is a story of a quest for power and control, for sole ownership of the symbolic seat of power called the Iron Throne. And there are seven kingdoms all vying for control of the land of Westeros. Each has its own unique strategy for gaining control of the throne, but one common thread connects them. It's the understanding that only one can wear the crown. Only one can sit on the throne, and everybody else that vies for the throne must be eliminated. The famous catchphrase early in the series says this: in the Game of Thrones, you either win or you die. There's no in between. There is no compromise. In order to win, others must be eliminated. This was true of the kings and queens that lusted after the throne. It was true of the kingdoms that vied for the power that came with it. And much like the real life battles throughout history that inspired George R.R. Martin to write his epic series, the central truth that we find again and again and again is that in the quest for control of a kingdom, there can be only one king. There can be only one true ruler. Only one deserves to sit on the throne. And in the war for your heart, the same is true for you. Only one can wear the crown. Only one can sit on the throne. Jesus said it well when he said that no person can serve two masters. He will either love the one or hate the other, or hate the one and love the other. There cannot be two masters. There cannot be two kings on the throne throughout history. Those types of alliances and allegiances always end with somebody dying. It never ends well. Because in a quest for power and a quest for control, anybody who desires it knows there can only be one. We must choose then whom we will serve. And to help us understand what's at stake, we have to begin our training, as it were, by revisiting perhaps the most well-known passage of Scripture, perhaps aside from John 3:16. It's one that if you grew up in a church, any church practically, you probably memorized this as a kid in Sunday school. But even if you have no church background at all, and this is your first time in a religious setting of any kind, you've probably heard of the Ten Commandments. Whether it's because of the blockbuster movies that are out there or the courthouses that have them adorned, or at least they have in the past, you are at least somewhat aware of this world-famous piece of legislation given by God through a man named Moses after he miraculously delivered the people of Israel out of slavery in Egypt. God led his people to the side of a mountain called Sinai and beckoned Moses to join him on the mount. Now, many of us who have this background in church can probably list off most, if not all, of the commandments. And if we can't name them all, we at least can hit the highlight. Most of us know the command, do not murder, or do not steal, or perhaps do not commit adultery, to have affairs and have sexual relations outside of marriage. Most people know about do not lie or bear false witness. And most good religious folks can remember to honor the Sabbath day to keep it holy, even if we really aren't great at that. But that's a story for another time. But if you find yourself trying to do that and coming up short, don't feel bad, because trying to figure out why you can only remember 7 or 8 of them is a common problem. Because even if you remember all 10, there's a good chance that you either have forgotten commands 1 and 2, or they are so seemingly passe and obsolete that you pay them no mind. But in Exodus chapter 20, verse 2, we see that the Ten Commandments starts out like this. This is God speaking. He says, I am the Lord your God who rescued you from the land of Egypt, the place of your slavery. Commandment number 1. You must not have any god before me. You must not make for yourself an idol of any kind or an image of anything in the heavens or on the earth or in the sea. You must not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God who will not tolerate your affections for any other gods. Now, for some of you, you're probably like, oh, yeah, those are the ones I forgot. Okay, so what? Because if you're like a lot of people, and in fact, when you talk to a lot of children about the Ten Commandments, and you talk about the importance of obeying the Ten Commandments, there's a good chance that most kids, because kids are smart, They will say, well, at least I only have to worry about eight of them because one and two are ones that I don't really have to worry about. In fact, when I see these quite typically, and for a lot of us, this is true. When we look at these, we are thankful that we don't live in a world, at least in the Western part of the world, where we have to worry about idolatry. For most of us, we think of it as obsolete, as archaic, as primitive even to our modern minds, because in our mind's eye, what we see when we see idolatry in gods is in the context of ancient cultures who are consumed by the demands of their god. Greece famously and influentially had a god for seemingly everything. Many of these names are familiar to us, even if it's only thanks to movies like Wonder Woman. There's Aphrodite, the goddess of beauty and love. There was Ares, the god of war. There was Artemis, the goddess of fertility, and Plutus, the god of wealth. And Hephaestus, the god of craftsmanship. Now, Jesus was right when he said that you cannot serve two masters, and the deities of these cultures proved it. These gods would often war with one another for dominance. In fact, the story of Greek mythology tends to be of warring gods, and gods who would marry and betray one another, and gods who were related to one another, and interfamily fighting and wars and destruction and murder. Because even though they were aligned together, eventually there was always a betrayal, because even the gods demanded dominance. The gods of Greece and other cultures, other ancient cultures, demanded your allegiance. They demanded sacrifice. They demanded fealty. They demanded your heart. But surely, we think, we have moved past this. Surely, we, in our enlightened 21st century minds, we have the sensibilities that would not allow the worship of idols to stand. Because we don't go to a temple and bow down. It is very, 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 very rare to see somebody in North America go to a temple and worship a literal idol. But don't allow your image of idolatry to convince you that idolatry is a thing of or is a thing that only people in India have to worry about, or China. Because idolatry is alive and well in our modern world. It's just moved underground. Sure, we no longer offer sacrifices to Aphrodite for the sake of finding love, but how many of us devote our entire lives to the pursuit of it? Or for the pursuit of beauty, for that matter? How many go to a temple of beauty and spend countless amounts of money for the pursuit of beauty? We may not worship in the temple of Artemis, but our families, or the desire to establish said families, can drive and dictate our entire lives. Children are no longer literally slain in the temple of Plutus. But the drive for wealth and for success has cost many a person their family. In fact, I would suggest that very little has changed, and that idolatry is alive and well, and perhaps more dangerous than ever, because once what was once a clearly defined war for your heart, with gods demanding your allegiance, has become a covert war where the combatants rarely know that they are fighting. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered a series of three sermons on idolatry back in the 60s that honestly quite hold up well all these years later. But early in his first sermon, he declared to his congregation a reminder that is still timely today. He said, "Certainly, worship is as natural to man as the rising of the sun is to the cosmic order. Men have always worshiped. Men will always worship. There is the ever-present danger, however, that man will direct his worship drive into false channels." Or as German philosopher Nietzsche puts it, there are more idols in the world than there are realities. Now, we may not worship by kneeling and bowing before a statue of an idol, but don't fool yourselves into thinking that we don't worship. You see, the gods of today are worshipped in tangible ways that form our thought process and our daily routine and our spending habits. We may not worship by literally bowing down, but we worship with our schedules and with our checkbooks. We worship with our browsing histories. We worship with what we are willing to prioritize, and we worship by what we are willing to sacrifice. Come to think of it, not much has changed. Even more, it's critical to understand and to recognize that idolatry isn't just one of many sins that we need to concern ourselves with. Idolatry is the one great sin that begins and pushes out all others. So if you start to scratch the surface of your struggles, if you are struggling with a sin in your life that you feel like you can't escape from, often what we do is we go and we identify the symptom and we treat the symptom. It's like taking cough medicine. And we allow that to be the self and we try to treat the symptom, but if you scratch a little deeper and you push a little further, you will generally find that the problem in our lives is that we have allowed a false god to take up residence in our heart. And until we dethrone that god, we will never have victory over the sin with which we struggle. In fact, the original Martin Luther, the one whom Martin Luther King was named for, the leader of the Protestant movement back in the 16th century, he challenges that before any of the other 9 commandments can be broken, always the first one is broken. There is always something that pushes you to break one of the other commandments, and it always starts with the one. Kyle Eidelman, in his book Gods at War, which is one of the inspirations for this series, puts it this way. He says, idolatry isn't an issue, it is the issue. All roads lead to the dusty, overlooked concept of false gods. Deal with life on the glossy outer layers and you might never see it. Scratch a little beneath the surface and you begin to see that it's always there under some other coat of paint. There are 100 million different symptoms, but the issue is always idolatry. So while we may have changed the names, while how we identify that which wars for our soul, it may be different, the same fundamental truth exists. Before we can get to the core of the manifestations of the sin in our lives, we have to get this right. We can't only treat the symptoms. We have to get to the root of the problem. Because we can go through our lives fighting coughing with NyQuil, but if the cough is caused by cancer, we may try to fight the battle, but we'll always lose the war. We must fight the core issue. We must remedy the cause. And in the war for your heart, we must choose who sits on the throne, because there can only be one. Novelist George Moore tells a story of the Great Depression. And I believe that this is a fabrication, but you can see where this would ring true. He says, in an effort to put men back to work, the government, which probably does a great job at doing this, I'm sure, decided to hire men to build roads out into the wilderness. And for a time, the work went well because the men were excited about the prospect of contributing both to society and contributing to providing for their families. Instead of being destitute, they had something to live for. They were ecstatic, even singing while they worked. But little by little, it began to dawn on them that something was wrong, something was off. Some of the men began to inquire where the road was leading to, but couldn't get an answer. And over time, they began to realize that the road leads nowhere. The project was merely a way for the government to put them to work and have an excuse for feeding them without hurting their pride. They were doing work that ultimately meant nothing. But now, instead of joyful exuberance, the men continued to work, but they did it with sadness, and they did it almost begrudgingly, because they knew that they were investing their lives into something that had no real value. And Moore insightfully concludes by saying this: roads to nowhere are difficult to build. Over these next few weeks, we're going to be challenged by several gods that we believe and we have clear evidence that are still alive and well, and for many of us, have taken up residence in our heart. Now, I want to kind of give a disclaimer here that this is possibly the hardest series to prepare for, because pastors struggle with this too. But if we don't wrestle with this, if we are not confronted by these idols and call them what they are, because we can give them all kinds of names and we can call them all kinds of things and we can defend them till our last breath, but if we don't call them what they are, we will never gain victory over them. And we will always find ourselves seeking for something and never finding it. We will always chase after a dream, after a vision of what could be, but we'll always find that we come up short. Like the author in the book of Ecclesiastes found, he said, I have seen that all the things that are done under the sun, and he means all of them, he spends the entire rest of the book laying them out. But he said, all of them are meaningless. A chasing after the wind. And humanity has a long and perhaps sordid history of chasing after the wind, of building roads that lead to nowhere, on investing our lives in the wrong direction. And even the people of God who have experienced his faithful love, witnessed his miraculous works, and beheld the dangers of turning your back on him, even they consistently and still consistently choose to break faith with God in a search for something else. At times it was the prosperity or success of the nations around them. Other kingdoms had wealth and prosperity that made God's people feel undervalued. So to gain what the nations had, they pursued what appeared to be their secret sauce, their gods. They would worship these gods, what the scriptures often refer to as pagan gods, referring to deities that are not Yahweh, the formal name of the God of Israel and of Christians today. Not only did they worship these gods, but their worship led them to value what these gods valued, and to act like these nations act and live as these nations lived, because they would discover before long that these paths required something of you. And even though they wanted what these nations had, they realized and began to recognize that there were demands in return. And they started to find that those demands were too much, and that the paths that they were laying down were roads that led to nowhere. And worse, not only were they worthless and unfruitful, but they spit in the very face of God who loved them, the God who was faithful to them, the God who had been patient and long-suffering, compassionate and forgiving. During one of these seasons, God addresses his people in terms of a grieved husband whose wife had been continually unfaithful in their marriage, in hopes that his people would wake up and see how far they had come. He brings charges of them in a legal accusation in the book of Jeremiah. And if you'd like to go there with me, Jeremiah chapter 2, we're going to kind of land there for a few moments. And in Jeremiah chapter 2, he says this. It'll be on our screens as well. He says, "This is the case I bring against you and your descendants. You can search from the coastlands of Kittim in the west to the deserts of Kedar in the east, and you won't find something as sickening as this. Has a nation ever exchanged its gods for some others? Even if they weren't really gods in the first place. But my beloved people have done just that. They have exchanged their glory to pursue worthless idols and their vain attempt for greater prosperity." Hold there for a second, because God is saying something quite powerful there by reminding his people that not even the worst of the worst, not even the nations that you would consider the most evil in history, at very least, God is saying they were faithful to their gods, even if they were terrible, even if they weren't gods at all, they were at least faithful to them. But no, my beloved people have done just that. They've exchanged their glory to pursue worthless idols in a vain attempt for greater prosperity. It would have been unthinkable for a pagan society to reject their gods, but not the people of Judah. So through his prophet Jeremiah, God continues in chapter 2, verse 13. He says, "My people are guilty of two evils. They have abandoned me, the spring of living water, and instead they have settled for dead and stagnant water from cracked, leaky cisterns of their own making." Jeremiah was writing to an ancient desert-dwelling community. And in these communities, having a reliable source of fresh water was the prerequisite for a society to survive. Now, the best source of water was what they would call living water, a rushing river that would never dry out. That was the dream. And for most of these societies, it was an illusion that they would never find and they'd never be able to embrace. With access to reliable water sources, the people were able to thrive and to flourish. Now, down the list, below living water, there was still good, but not ideal, access to wells or streams. Well, the problem with wells or streams is that in a desert community, they would sometimes run out in the heat of the summer. They would dry up, but typically they would return with the rains. And at the bottom of the list, all the way down here, were cisterns. And these were essentially large bowls or pots that would be embedded in the ground to collect rainwater. Or in an emergency, they may go down, they may travel for miles to go to a source of water and bring it back to their cisterns so they had water to drink and to cook with. Water in these cisterns, of course, would become stagnant and become fouled in the heat. They'd attract mosquitoes and become a cesspool of disease. So no person in the ancient Near East would ever trade a fountain of living water for a cistern at all, full stop. Not a broken cistern, just a cistern at all, given the choice between the two. Much less the insanity of choosing a broken cistern, because a broken cistern cannot hold water. But much like the insanity of choosing a broken cistern when you have a river with which to gain water, God said his people traded their God for the God of these foreign pagan deities. Because though they could have life and they could thrive and flourish and have beauty and sustenance because of the streams and the river of living water, they chose to thirst to death. They would never find the life that they wanted, because with cracked and broken cisterns would always lead to dehydration. Jeremiah continues in verse 19, and I'll warn you, he doesn't hold back on the adultery angle here. In fact, he uses quite strong language to describe his people's betrayal. So fair warning, this probably may even go beyond PG for you, but I'm reading from the Bible, so what are you going to do, get mad at me? He He says this. He says, "So says the eternal Lord, commander of heavenly armies. A long time ago, I broke the yoke that weighed you down and tore off the chains that enslaved you. But still you boldly say, 'I will not serve you.' Instead, you bow down like a whore to pagan gods on a high hill and under every green tree. I'm the one who planted you like a select vine chosen from vintage stock. How could you turn into such a useless, wild weed of a vine? You can scrub yourself with all the soap that you want, but you'll never be able to wash away the stain of what you've done before me." Not only had God's people forsaken the best to embrace the very worst, but they did it at the expense of their relationship with their one true love. They had embraced their lives of chasing after the wind. Jeremiah uses this metaphor of a choice vine planted to bear fruit. And it's a familiar metaphor, especially if you've been following my devotional podcast, because we've been talking about vines and branches and fruits and life. It's a continued metaphor that the scriptures use all throughout the Old and New Testament to reinforce the truth that to discover life, we have to find it in him. Anytime we choose to exchange God for something else, something counterfeit, we trade the Creator for something less, for something counterfeit. As commentator John Oswald writes, he says, "God made humans to find their truest self in loving him. And when we love the creation more than we love him and demonstrate that love by depending on it to supply our deepest needs, he is hurt and angered, not only for what it does to him, but what it does to us. When we seek life from any other source other than God, it is relying on cracked cisterns to provide water. It's attempting to catch the wind. It's like we are building a road to nowhere." And there's no end to the number of counterfeits that try to worm their way into our heart, to vie for our attention, to become our priority, whether it's people or ideologies or concepts and careers and pursuits. They all fight for prominence in our hearts. But what we tend to think of when we think of idols, is we tend to think of something evil. We tend to think of things that are wrong, because historically, especially in the scriptures, these are demonstrably evil. But what we find in modern idolatry, and we find it in scripture if we know where to look, more often than not, the barrier to being sold out for God, the barrier to giving God the throne of our lives, is not bad or wrong. That happens a lot, but that's not the only one. And especially in the church, what we find instead are not quote unquote bad things, but they are ostensibly good things. Things that we could even argue are gifts from God. In fact, in his book Counterfeit Gods, Tim Keller argues that these good things can create the greatest potential danger. He writes, "The greater the good, the more likely we are to expect that it can satisfy our deepest needs and hopes. Anything can serve as a counterfeit God, especially the very best things in life. Careers, hobbies, friendships, even family, good things given by God to build us up and to provide stability and for our enjoyment. But the danger exists that these gifts can take the place of the giver. You see, anything that becomes a substitute for God in our hearts becomes an idol. Anything that we choose to find our joy, we choose to satisfy our longings, that we choose to depend on to meet our needs, or we choose to become the source of our shelter instead of God, stakes a claim on our heart to which only God is entitled. Instead of reaching out to God for nourishment, we reach out to these things. Then these good things take the place of what's best and become harmful. They suck the life out of us instead of nourishing us. They become cracked and broken cisterns when God is offering us streams of living water. Jesus reminds us in John 15 that he alone is the true source of life. He says, I am the true vine and the Father is the vine grower. He removes every branch in me that bears no fruit. Every branch that bears fruit, he prunes to make it bear more fruit. You have already been cleansed by the words that I have spoken to you. Abide in me as I abide in you. Just as a branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. Earlier in John, Jesus also reminds his listeners that whoever believes in me, as the scriptures has said, rivers of living water will flow from within them. You see, if Jesus is the genuine article, if Jesus is the source of life, if Jesus is the only one worthy of our adoration and our worship, if Jesus is the only one deserving to sit on the throne of our lives, then it gives us access to true life, to rushing living water that we've been thirsting for our whole lives. But Jesus challenges his followers to commit to following him by abiding in him. And this isn't a passive thing that we do. It's not something that we just remain. I can remain here and do nothing. But that's not what Jesus is saying. Jesus is challenging us to make a decision, to make a conscious act of reaching out and grabbing on, refusing to let go. It's a choice that we make day by day, even moment by moment. It's an obedience that we engage in that creates space in our lives and our schedules for the giver and not just his gifts. And it's a continued obedience that Jesus promises will result in true joy. John 15, 11, he says, I have said these things so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. When we give Jesus the rightful place on the throne of our heart, when we rely on him for sustenance and for life, we discover that everything else in our lives begin to fall into place. But we have to give God the rightful place on the throne of our lives. We must allow him to wear the crown, and we must forcefully, intentionally revoke any other claim to it. We must commit ourselves, and perhaps for the first time, we must commit ourselves to keeping the first commandment. You must not have any other gods but me. Over these next few weeks, we're going to be recruited to engage in our own war, our own Game of Thrones, fighting not for our rightful place, but for God's. And while some of us will be able to see the inherent value of each week's teachings without maybe understanding the stakes that we are given, it is crucial that we remember that until we diagnose the disease, we won't be able to embrace the cure. So this day, choose whom you will serve. Choose to open your heart to the giver of rivers of living water. Don't settle for broken cisterns. Don't settle for chasing after the wind. Don't settle for roads that lead to nowhere, but choose to intentionally reach out and to grab a hold of Jesus, abiding in the vine and creating space for him where only he belongs. And in doing so, you begin a journey toward freedom and joy and peace that so many of us have longed for, but too many of us missed. Give God the throne of your heart, and you'll discover that it changes everything. I'm going to ask if the worship team would come back up. We're going to close with a song that's a bit older. And by older, I mean older for me. It's called Heart of Worship. And it's a very simple song, but it is a song of confession and repentance, a song of rededication that says, God, you deserve it. You are the God of endless worth. You are the King that deserves my heart, but I recognize and I confess that I have messed it.
up. And the goal that God had in that spring Jeremiah, and the reality of what Jesus was offering, is he's bringing these two metaphors together. One of a ruined vine, that God said, you can wash all you want, but you will never wash away the stain of what you've done. But Jesus is offering and saying, and he said it there to the men who had already given his lives, he said, you have already been cleansed. So even though at the time Israel heard that there was no hope, Jesus was saying, what you couldn't do, because God wasn't saying God couldn't cleanse them. He was saying they couldn't cleanse themselves. But Jesus was saying, where you have failed before, I will win now. Where you have squandered your opportunity before, I will not waste it. Where you have dirtied yourself before, I will clean you. So this morning, maybe you're here and this has been very real for you. And maybe you know in your heart that you have been pushing God aside, pushing God away, and you've been chasing after the wind. You've been building roads that lead to nowhere, and you have found, like Solomon and Ecclesiastes, that it is worthless and meaningless, and it leaves you empty. And maybe you want to exchange those broken cisterns for rivers of living water. Today, I want to invite you. I mean, you know that the altars are open, and this, if there was ever a time that the altars, man, are necessary in these seasons for me, in these seasons where I have to pour myself out to God. Sometimes it's on Sunday. Sometimes you might come in here and not be able to find me because I'm in here, because I recognize that, again, that posture of kneeling and bowing. Because even though we don't tend to bow, especially us Americans, we don't do that. We don't bow to the king. There's something about bowing to the rightful king, the king that has won our hearts, that won victory, and deserves our worship. So I want to invite you. We're gonna stand, and I want to encourage you and maybe even challenge you to make a choice today to choose God, to choose the rivers of living water, and not to settle for broken cisterns anymore, to not settle for chasing after the wind, for not choosing to settle for roads that lead to nowhere. So as Mickey leads us in this song, I'd invite you, I encourage you to come and join us. I'm actually gonna kind of hang out up here too, because even if you're not struggling with this, even if this is something that you feel like, you know what, I'm okay,